qui m'a souhaité bon anniversaire et merci d'être là. On finit avec...
Hello, everybody, and welcome to John Abbott on the Air for CKUT 90.3 FM. Joined by Daniel and Susan, I'm Dusty Goldberg. Over recent years, there's been a surge in the popularity of vegetarian diets, vegan diets, and other dietary plans that don't include meat. This eruption has sparked a conversation throughout society today. Is a diet that contains meat more or less healthy than one without meat? To get a consensus of what people believe simply based on common knowledge, we interviewed students at John Abbott College to see which of the two they thought was healthier. Here are the responses we received.
I think that a vegetarian lifestyle is better because animals are horribly mistreated. People are force breeding animals and hurting them, which I think is obviously very not good. If you look at the example of cows, people are overbreeding them and even just mistreating them, but also just cows in general are not bad, and the fact that we're overbreeding them for hamburgers and to eat tasty food like that isn't very good. Their farts are producing a lot of emissions that are hurting the planet a lot, so I think that overproduction of different animals like that is actually harming our planet, and so I think that overall people should have more plant-based diets.
I think a diet that involves meat is more healthier because there's other options that you can match with the meat, like vegetables, that also still makes it a healthy meal. And meat still provides you protein that helps build up your muscles. So people that go to the gym can't live off of a vegetarian diet because there's not enough protein for them to build up muscle.
So in the long term, having a vegetarian diet is very good for your health. It could decrease very chronic diseases like high cholesterol and heart diseases, etc. But people stay away from vegetarian diets because they think that's going to get you lack of protein, which is a lie, because foods like vegetables, milk, and meat alternatives have that amount of proteins. Just like fish, eggs, tofu, etc.
I think a regular diet with meat would be greater than a vegetarian diet. I feel like when you go on a vegetarian diet, you're lacking protein. I don't know, of course you got beans, you got peanuts, you got all sorts of tofu, all sorts of other sources of protein, but you're missing the true what chicken has to provide, what fish, what beef. You're missing those key contents of protein. I feel like that's a big part of a diet. Of course, if you're just eating more vegetables, on the vegetarian diet, there's more benefits there. But, you could still do that on a regular diet. You don't have to cut out meat to just eat more vegetables. That's not how it goes. I think if you just include more vegetables and have a healthy balance of protein in it, I feel like just a regular diet with meat would be better.
The feedback that we got from our John Abbott peers was varied. Daniel and I then met with Samara Lasner, the on-site nutritionist at St. Ronnie Schwanster Academy. We asked her the same question, and this is what she had to say.
This is an interesting question because technically they're both healthy. For example, a diet containing meat means you have a higher chance of having high cholesterol. But on the other hand, it also means you have a much higher chance of having good levels of iron in your blood. So when choosing the kind of diet you want, it really doesn't matter if you're a meat eater or a vegan. It really depends on your personal preference and the choices that fit your lifestyle, and it's largely about balance. So you can eat meat and still have a lower cholesterol and enough iron and be healthy, and by the same token you can be a vegan and you can be very unhealthy. So in both cases it's about moderation and having balance, a little bit of everything.
So it turns out everyone was right. Sort of. While there's different benefits of eating a meat exclusion diet and a meat inclusion diet, they're both healthy. But the name of the game is moderation. You can live on either of these dietary practices and live a happy, healthy life, as long as you get the full circle of nutrients that you need. This has been a great learning experience for us, and if you didn't know before, now you do. For CKUT 90.3 FM, John Abbott on the air, I'm Dusty Goldberg. Stay classy, everybody.
Hello and welcome to the Mental Health Hotline. If you're depressive, it doesn't matter which number you press, no one will answer you.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Isabella Ninchevich with my partner Alex Laney, and today we're discussing John Abbott College's mental health resources. We asked students on campus and an expert's opinion on whether they think John Abbott College has enough mental health resources for students in need. Here are the answers we got.
I personally don't think that John Abbott has enough resources because I know of a few, but most of the time, like, I know that they're fully booked or, like, it's hard to get in touch with people. So, no, I don't think there's enough.
Okay, so personally, I don't think that we have enough resources. It's more, like, to help you find out what you want to do with yourself in the future. And I don't think that they have enough resources for mental health, for psychologists and things like that, or even like to help people get the help that they need for at home if there's at home issues or things like that. So yeah,
I think that John Abbott would benefit from more specific kind of mental health resources, like for, I don't know, drug addiction, or one that's like big with like teenagers is like the nicotine addiction, like people vaping a lot on campus. If I feel like if John Abbott like were to broaden its mental health resources, a lot of students would benefit from it.
Congress has actually already spoken about mental health before. We've had several discussions and ideas on what to implement into the school. We've talked about zones for relaxation, maybe a nap zone, somewhere calm for people to take a rest, especially because you can't really sleep in the clubs or, you know, just in the hallways. We've also thought about adding other amenities, maybe like a place where people can de-stress, maybe selling, like, you know, those fidget toys. More concrete changes, like adding more psychiatrists, having a mental health, like, we already have a mental health day, but adding more stuff to help people with big problems, such as awareness week for stuff like panic attacks, because a lot of people don't actually know how to deal with panic attacks.
All right, so I believe John Abbott maybe have the services, but don't provide them efficiently enough. For example, last semester, I was not in a good spot and tried to get in contact with a counselor, and it took months before I could see one. And by then, my grades had already dropped. I had already dropped a class that I couldn't follow anymore. So yeah, it was way too long.
And here is Michelle Quaz, the psychology professor at John Abbott College.
Again, so it's about John Abbott services. We do have several services. Specifically for mental health, we have our counseling services. So we do have drop-in. I know that there's emergency drop-in and also by appointments. So, but for more details, I mean, they're going to be the ones to have it, but we do offer that service for sure. I don't know if you guys have heard, but there's also a new employee to our mental health program here, and it's a dog. It's Max, the wellness dog, and so he's actually an official employee for Abbott Go, and it's a kind of pet therapy, which is more and more common today. So I thought that was really super cool.
To conclude today's episode, Michelle stated that there are enough resources at John Abbott College for mental health for students. However, the students did not agree. We believe that the reason why students do not agree is because resources that the college have are not advertised enough. For better mental health resources, there needs to be a change in the way that the college presents mental health. My name is Alex Laney with Isabella Ninchevich. On John Abbott on the air, CKUT 90.3 FM.
How I lost myself again, but I remember you.
Hi, this is Adriana Ford-Scanaberry, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, John Abbott on the Air. Today we'll be talking about Artemisia Gentileschi. Artemisia Gentileschi was born in Rome in the year of 1593. She started to paint when she was young, but it was really to the age of 17 she started to flourish. This young woman was one of the most powerful women when it came to painting in the Baroque age, being that most women did not have any source of job besides taking care of their household and bearing children. She created a voice for most women, being that most of her art was targeted towards her abuse and her assault when she was younger. Many would say Artemisia was the representation of resistance for sexual oppression. She was one of the first females to actually paint the perpetrator being murdered by the victim, and she also used all of her history, her life, to embody what expression was. Many would say Artemisia's art depicts feminism today. And I would like to bring Sophie Prince to talk about more of her life and why she is important in today's society for women.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in art.
I'm a professor at John Abbott College. I teach mostly French, but I also teach Universal of the Arts, which is mostly art history class. I come from France. I studied in France, and then I came to Canada, and I studied at McGill. I did to be a French teacher, and then I was kind of specialized into the history of the French language. And then, like, one step to another step led me to doing more and more history until they said, hey, why don't you teach history of the art? And here I am teaching French and history of the art.
So one of my questions today is why Artemisia is important today.
Okay, first, Artemisia is a 17th century Italian painter. She's important on several levels. History tend to discard everything that is women, okay? And we are never sure whether they are good enough, or they as good as men. With Artemisia, there's absolutely no doubt that she's not only as good as men, but she's considered as one of the best Baroque painters. So you cannot just discard her because she's a woman. And also, she had a very tough life. As far as, how can I say, she was discriminated several times in her life.
So you mentioned that she was discriminated against. How was she discriminated throughout her life?
Okay, when she was a child, she studied painting with her father, okay? And at some point, she wanted to go to an art school. So first, she was not allowed to go to an art school because she was a woman. Okay, so her father had a private teacher for her, and the private teacher violently raped her. Okay, and in the 19th century, how you deal with rape? You ask the rapist to marry the girl. It's a very, very strange idea to us, but that's how they were thinking, that it would, you know, cleanse the problem and so on. So he asked, the father asked the rapist to marry her. He refused to marry her for one good reason: he was already married, so he couldn't marry her. So the father, the rapist, so it went to trial, not because he raped her, because he refused to marry her. And so she started talking about the rape and what happened. It lasted 9 months, and they tortured her to see if what she was saying was true. They badly tortured her. She had a gynecology exam in front of a public. Can you imagine that? They put ropes around the fingers and they tied it to break her fingers. I mean, it's, for a painter, it's terrible to have your fingers broken, right? Anyway, Tassi was condemned to 5 years of exile, so not even prison, just exile. And you know what? He didn't do it. He just stayed there in Napoli. Nothing happened to him. She was very, very angry about it. And later on in her life, when she became a famous painter. She was hoping to do big frescoes and to have big orders, but every time they would never give her big orders because she was a woman. She was asked to do little portraits, little land styles, still life, sorry. She was asked to do what women were expecting to do, you know, the portrait of another woman, a bunch of flowers, okay? And no, she wanted to do big frescoes. And another thing, again, I mean, yet another discrimination. When she started being famous, when her paintings came out of school, people said, oh, her father's a painter. It's not her. It's her father who's doing the painting. So she had to prove to her teachers that she actually was doing it herself. She actually painted in front of her teachers to prove them, okay? And yet another discrimination. Eventually, she was so good that one school said, okay, we're going to take one woman, that girl, she's really good, let's take her. But there was a class with nude male, but she was not allowed to go because a nude male, you know, a woman is going to go crazy if she sees a nude male. I'm being sarcastic, of course, okay? So she could not take that class, so she could not graduate because of that missing class. So what she did is she paid men outside of class to pose for her. She did the work herself. She gave the drawings and the paintings to the teachers, and the teacher said, wow, it's so good. We have no choice but to pass her. So can you imagine? They didn't want to pass her because she was a female, but they said, we have no choice but to pass her. So imagine how good she is. So just imagine all this discrimination throughout her life.
One thing we can take from this story is that although Artemisia did not have a great life, she used her life struggle to express her passion for art. She uplifted others, especially women during that era, and she's a great inspiration.
This is Adriana Ford Scannelberry, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. Thank you. Bye.
I'm Leticia Briand, and I'm at John Abbott College with my co-host Lauren Murphy, speaking to students about the school system. We ask students if they believe that the school system has been set up to benefit and aid every type of learner, and why. The answers we received may surprise you just as much as they surprised us.
I would say no, because growing up, my sister and I had a lot of the same teachers because we were a couple years apart, and I'd do pretty okay in school. I wouldn't need to study for anything, but I know my sister, she really needed to study hard. She still does need to study hard. I think there's also a lot of stereotypes with that too, and that, like, my sister, because she would take more time to learn things, she actually had a teacher call her stupid in the classroom in front of everybody because she wasn't like her bigger sister. So I think for sure that school is not structured to fit for everybody.
No, because everyone learns differently, but at the same time it is difficult to accommodate to everyone's needs.
No, I do not believe it is fit for everyone, because everyone learns differently and the school system does not care about how you learn, and they just teach you how they teach you.
No, I don't think that the school system accommodates every type of learner, because especially in the science program, usually exams are very heavily weighted. Even if you're doing well throughout the whole semester, most of the time the exam will decipher whether you succeed or not. And I think there should be more assessments that have smaller weights that determine whether you're actually learning, compared to just one exam that's worth between 60 to 75% of your grade.
We also met with Louise Kazuo-Take, a professor at John Abbott College in the math department. Take does not believe in school systems that solely base students' grades off numerical outcomes. Here are some things he has to say about the matter.
I don't think it's possible for the school system the way it is nowadays to benefit every possible type of learner, because, for instance, at McGill, I remember seeing classes with hundreds of students. Fortunately, that's not the case here. But even here, like, I teach three groups of almost 25, 30 students each. So that's 80 students per semester. It's just humanly impossible to try to adapt to every single student's peculiarity and needs. It's just not possible. So we would have to have a lot smaller class sizes to be able to provide a suited education for everybody. I've been experimenting different things. Right now I'm trying to, so in the past, like for my calculus students, for instance, I had just quizzes, tests, and exams, that's it. Now this semester I replaced the quiz component by assignments, and it's not like you submit it and that's it. Either you that's the grade you got is the grade you got. I'm doing things a little differently. So for instance, they submit an assignment. I don't give a grade. Instead, I give some feedback, written feedback. They take this written feedback and then they redo the assignment. And so the idea is that they will keep doing this until they learn the material. And I think this is much, much more like in the spirit of a real school, that we are here not to rank the students, but to help them learn. And if it takes 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times to do it, then we should try to do it as much as possible. So I don't know what will happen at the end of the semester, but I feel like, and the students that talked to me about this, they all told me that they really prefer this. And they comparing this to quizzes, they definitely prefer this, and it's less stressful. And
after hearing from Professor Louise Kizuwatake and students of John Abbott College, we have come to the realization that most people believe that school systems aren't suitable for every type of learner. This is extremely concerning, as most of children and young adults' lives consist of going to school to, quote, have a better future. How can these students succeed if their future is based off a faulty system? Louise believes that students can benefit more from assignments that are resubmitted until the materials are actually grasped by the student, instead of the typical getting the question right or wrong. The quote-unquote grading would be more based off the evolution of the student and the grasp of the concept, rather than the way they perform on a test or exam. Thank you for listening to our segment on Are School Systems Set Up to Benefit Every Type of Student? We hope you enjoyed listening as much as we enjoyed making it. And we also hope that you learned something new. I'm Lauren Murphy, and my co-host is Leticia Briand for John Abbott on the Air on CKUT 90.3 FM. Thank you, and have a great day.
Today we have a pretty fun topic lined up for you, and I suppose I can ask the same question to you as well. Where do you see virtual reality in about 10-15 years' time? Virtual reality, or VR for those who don't know, is best summarized as another way to watch videos or play video games. The big difference is that instead of looking at a computer or phone screen, you're wearing a fancy device on your head that immerses you in a virtual world. Having worked with a couple companies in the past on various VR titles, I can definitely say that I have an interest in where this technology is heading. By far, the coolest aspect about VR is the fact that it can take you to a completely different place that you couldn't, for example, travel to. Let's say that a person can't afford to travel across the planet and go to a museum. If VR were to become just slightly more affordable, a person could visit the Smithsonian or the pyramids of Egypt and still get to experience those sorts of locations in that way. There's also the aspect that VR is mostly known for, which is video games. It's hard to ignore. There's nothing more immersive than placing yourself in the game to make yourself feel more involved. However, there are still some limitations that are holding it back. To get a little bit more insight on what those are and the possibilities of VR in the near future, I spoke with James Murray of Andromeda Studios, a local indie game studio based in Montreal that's focused on creating VR games.
All right, so the killer app for VR is gaming. I think everyone sort of understands that. I think that's where most of the money is, where most of the investment is. And the reason that the technology is, in general, developing at the pace that it is due to the large market of people that want to have immersive entertainment experiences. I think everyone has sort of a reality, sort of like a a 1960s view of, you know, where is this technology going to go, you know, in 10, 15 years? Are we going to be, is it going to be like Sword Art Online, you know, the popular anime where we could, you know, there's the movement is one-to-one. Now, I can't really speak for that. What I will say is that the problem with VR, you know, 4 or 5 years ago was that it was just too overhyped. It was too expensive. The materials, the software, they weren't there. And these companies like Oculus and HTC and even PSVR, even though I do think they're a good example of those three, I think they kind of killed the initial wave of excitement because it just, the industry as a whole wasn't ready. And I think people expected too much. You know, they cost $400 to $500 per unit. You know, people don't like clunky controllers. They don't like things attached to wires. It just wasn't there yet. And I think Valve Index is actually the closest we've come to something a bit more long term. You know, Half-Life Alyx is like one of the greatest. It's a landmark for VR. But I even think, you know, and Xbox and Sony, they haven't really shown enough interest in VR for it to really take off. You know, they say their consoles, you know, their hardware is capable, but they backtrack so much. And I think for them, it's like, unless there's without a doubt a real need for VR, they're not going to really support it, because PSVR as of right now isn't really on PS5. It's not, they're not really giving it enough attention for it to really take off. So it's left up to these other, you know, smaller companies to pick up the slack. And I think that's why VR has taken such a long time.
But James doesn't just think about VR in the gaming aspects. He also thinks that there are some amazing real-world applications.
The reason why VR is so important is it's really not just gaming. Gaming's sort of like the pioneering aspect of it. You know, we have education, we have medical students being able to use it for, you know, real simulations of what it's like to actually have a procedure. You know, these training programs, they can make such accurate real-life representations of what it's like to be in the ER. And I think there are so many cases where creating a stress-free environment to learn will help the transition into the workforce so much easier. You know, there's been studies, you know, that say that these medical students that are trained by VR, they often end up being more accurate than their peers that use traditional methods. So I think, you know, when VR headsets get smaller, they get lighter, they incorporate more features, I think people are starting to notice, because like I said earlier, you know, people don't want wires, they don't want clicking controllers, they don't want, you know, they don't want things hampered down by clutter. They want something that feels like they could actually incorporate it into their day-to-day lives instead of something they show up to their friends once in a while.
There's always going to be certain things that hold technology back from getting to its most perfect form. James attributes that to a couple different aspects.
You know, like VR glasses, for example. Something that can allow for, you know, eye tracking technology, so when the human eye can, you know, create the best resolution possible, because the parts of the image that the user is looking at actually adjust to their attention. I think things that can reduce nausea, lag, once these challenges are out of the way, I think VR can really start to take off. And it's really difficult for me to say when that will happen. It's very difficult. It really depends on if in the pace that we're at continues, and I think it will. Do I think it'll become a greater source of entertainment than, say, what we have now within the next five to 10 years? I'm really not sure. But I think things like VR chat, you know, Rec Room, things that allow people to communicate, I think people will start to realize that it's more than just a gizmo. It actually does bring people together.
VR is definitely here to stay. It'll just keep improving. It's just a matter of time of how long it'll take for the improvements to take hold. In my own opinion, and from what I've experienced in VR, there's definitely something here that can really take off. It's just a matter of time and commitment from the big players in the industry, such as Facebook, PlayStation, or even Google and Samsung. Once again, I'm Adam Sheridan. You've been listening to John Abbott on the air on CKUT 90.3 FM, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is John Abbott on the air. I'm Evie Stockvis. See you next time.
Now Cara Patties is on a fast break with Veggie Patty leading the charge. The pass is down deep to Goat Patty. Goat Patty passes baseline to Beef Patty. Beef Patty shoots from downtown at the buzzer. And bingo! It's in! It's in! Cara Patties wins the game and is now the world champions! the number one in Montreal. Come on down to 9550 Jean Milo in LaSalle for the best patties, roadies, jerk chicken, and more. Or call us at 438-387-4004. Cara Patties, the champions of Montreal.